In this story, when you hear this, turn the page. Let's begin now.
Welcome to Dissident Island. It is episode 235 on the 7th of June 2019. We have a packed show for you tonight. We'll be playing you out with DJ Oleotronics, playing some chiptune. Before that, we've got a three-part interview with Nick from Housemans on the Alliance of Radical Booksellers, Bread and Roses Book Prize, and how the radical book trade is doing. Sandwiched in between, we've got ACAB Andy, who'll be giving us some updates on legal wages.
Evening all.
But first, we're going to start with the youth climate strike. We're speaking to
Ruby.
Hi, Ruby. So on May the 15th, 3 weeks ago, 24th, shit. So on May the 24th, there were student strikes in 125 locations in the UK.
Yeah.
So that was the fourth, and the fifth youth climate strike is taking place in 2 weeks' time, right?
Yes.
On Friday, June the 21st. Yeah. Do you want to say a bit about how the last one went?
So I'm part of a student campaign called Student Climate Action, or SCAR for short, as we're trying to brand it now. And we are a coalition of students that grew out of wanting to create a campaign in solidarity with the youth strikers, school strikes that started like beginning of this year, I think, and then kind of grew into a more coherent anti-capitalist environmentalist group. So we've been mobilising university students mostly, but on the day it was very energetic. All of the strikes I've found have been incredibly, a lot of energy and a lot of movement at times. Like the kids were just literally like running down the Mall towards like Buckingham Palace at one point.
Exuberant youthful energies.
A very kind of confused as well vibe, I'd say. But overall, a lot of radical politics on the street. A lot of very woke kids, which was pretty cool.
So you said the group that you're with morphed into an anti-capitalist politics. How is that being received by the youth?
So we wanted to just create a campaign that was environmentalist at first and just to do actions around the youth strikes. And then it kind of emerged out of our demands are about divestment and democratisation of universities and decolonisation. And we didn't feel that there was an existing campaign that was political in that way and that was linking together issues of race and class and, well, essentially a campaign that was challenging capitalism and saying that capitalism necessitates socio-ecological degradation. And we didn't really feel that like we were represented by groups like Extinction Rebellion or most of the very liberal groups at most universities. I could tell you like 10 very kind of neoliberal groups at UCL anyway. So we felt that wasn't really represented. Yeah, so it's just kind of grown out of motivation to create a more political, direct action focused campaign. Mm-hmm.
And how are you engaging with groups like the Youth Climate Strike, or when you go out into demos, are you kind of making an extra effort to engage with people?
So there's Extinction Rebellion Youth, who are like a kind of offshoot of Extinction Rebellion and in some ways are a bit more radical actually. So we put out a statement that was in coalition of them, and we had like a block at the last strike, so that's kind of how it felt. And then I know that the UKSN, the UK Climate Strike Network, they're doing lots of actions like throughout the year, so we're trying to work with them to engage with their protests and their direct action.
What do you think of the students taking to strike action? That's kind of, I find that super interesting, no? Like teaching students the confidence to strike, the ability to stand up and walk out, and I feel like that could potentially have long-term impacts as well on how they engage politically. Like, have you felt anything like that on the street?
Yeah, for sure. I think university students, we don't really have the same connection to government or to the state, really. And like, our universities, it doesn't really make the same impact if we go on strike. But the school strikers, I think, are very like aware of the statement that they're making when they're going on strike. And it is kind of interesting that I did feel like climate change is quite fashionable at the moment. Like the kids are on strike. We're the cool kids, which is quite interesting. It didn't really feel like they were particularly like came from families that were really political. It felt like they were just really interested in these issues and they'd sort of radicalized themselves in a way, which is pretty cool.
Do you think it's going to have much of a... So when we look back at the student protests of 2011 and kind of going on, there has been a bit of a swell in the leftist milieu since then of people who engaged with politics for the first time then and then have continued to stay committed. And do you feel like we've got hope?
I hope so. I'd like to think so. Yeah, these protests have been one of the, like, especially at UCL, like the largest protests that we've had in years. And it's still growing and there are movements all over the world now. It's really insane. I think there's a general strike planned for September. I don't know how effective that would be, but it's quite interesting that there is like the appetite for those kind of movements. I think it would be good if they can engage more trade unions to make it a stronger, more powerful campaign. Because I know the global strike was supposed to be, I think their bio on the event was like, we're going to radicalise all of the different economic sectors in society. But in reality, it is still largely people that are like in a privileged position to be able to like leave school and that kind of thing. So I don't know whether a general strike is really going to happen to the same like level that it has in the past, but I hope so.
It would be incredible. So I guess another question I have is like, is there much engagement with the... So it was maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was another kind of swell in the ecological movement in the UK. So like Earth First, Camp for Climate Action, Rising Tide. And there was a shift at some point where during that time, people started paying real attention to the transition economy, like how you would transition away from things like coal, which is, it's a worker struggle issue, right? It's a case of a place where relatively, or what's considered to be middle class politics of climate change come into direct conflict potentially, or come into tension with a working class politics. And so there was a real movement to try to address that. Is that analysis and that kind of transition economy discussions, is that happening in the climate movement at the moment, do you feel?
Of making the climate issue more of a class issue, or
how do you deal
engaging
with that when
yeah, I think that is a real, like, it's a huge problem, and that most of the environmental movement is still really white. And even like my campaign, we have really long discussions about engaging people of color and oppressed groups, and yet like most of the campaign is still white, which is really bad.
Why do you think that is?
I think it is still seen as a middle class issue. I think there are a lot of environmental groups that are making a lot of headway and trying to make it more intersectional, but it is still I think you still have to be in a position of privilege to kind of to think about environmental issues. And if you're working class, or if you're poor, or if you're someone of colour, then you're not always going to be in a position to like engage with those politics as much, I don't think. And especially if groups like Extinction Rebellion aren't making the environmental movement accessible. So I think this is kind of like a cultural thing that's...
It's interesting because the consequences of climate change are going
to hit
kind of non-majority white countries pretty hard.
No, I think it is incredibly important to centre the environmental campaign movement around frontline communities, because obviously they were hit the hardest and first. And yeah, I think like groups like Reclaim the Power are definitely doing a lot of work in that regard, but there's still a lot more work needs to be done to make more of a class analysis of the environmentalist movement.
Cool. And what are your hopes for the June 21st demo?
Hopefully it'll be big. The problem is that it's during A-level season. Ooh. So I don't know how big it will be compared to May.
Everyone needs a day off from
revision,
then.
Exactly.
Revision
But some of, there's 14-year-olds that are organising a lot of the main strike, and they are doing so much work. It's mad. I'm in like a lot of WhatsApp chats, and they just move 100 miles an hour. So,
that's brilliant.
Yeah, they're incredibly dedicated.
And if people want to get plugged into that and support the students, what would be the best way to go about it?
So we have a Twitter account, which is at Student Climate Action, if they can follow that. And then the UKSN Facebook page and Twitter for the youth strikes. I think those are sort of the two ones that I'm involved in. But yeah, it's mostly through all sorts of social media sites.
Awesome. So we encourage people to go down and engage with the students, and that would be great. Thank you for coming in to talk with us. So we've got a jingle for you now, and then we'll go straight into the interview with Nick from Housemans.
At Dissident Islands Radio,
we're famous for two things.
Two, push pineapple, shake the tree.
One, creating delicious
interviews,
especially for
left-wing militants.
Some are you,
hey,
got to know respect.
Hey,
why you look at
and two, our awful taste in
jingles.
You can.
I can't.
I feel like
Dissident Island
Radio
tonight.
How else could we explain this?
Editing.
Great
interviews.
Lousy
jingles.
Dissident Island
Radio.
You're listening to another segment of Blast from the Past, where we delve into the 11 years worth of archived Dissident Island radio shows to check in with a campaign or group we haven't heard from recently. This time around, we'll be hearing from Nick, who works at Housemans Bookshop. Housemans Bookshop is located in the King's Cross area of London and is a not-for-profit bookshop specializing in books, zines, and periodicals of radical interest and progressive politics, offering a huge range of radical literature of all kinds, in addition to hosting events for writers and readers alike. We last heard from Nick in a really entertaining interview we did with him nearly 8 years ago in 2012 on episode 99 of Dissident Island. When we spoke to Nick back in 2012, we discussed the inception of the Bread and Roses Award for Radical Publishing, a prize which was organized out of the Alliance of Radical Booksellers, which also had been launched around the same time. This time around, we caught up with Nick to discuss this year's Bread and Roses Prize, how things were going with the Alliance of Radical Booksellers, and also about Housemans Bookshop itself, one of the booksellers in the Alliance, and the fact that it's turning 60 years old this year. What is the Alliance, for people that don't already know?
The Alliance is a continuation of something that was running in the 80s, the Federation of Radical Booksellers, which was a large organisation. I think they had about 120 bookshops or so as members. And as time passed into the late 80s and the 90s, a lot of shops closed, and the Federation went with it. And yeah, there was a desire and I think a need to restart it. And we felt that what with technology, emails and so forth existing, it wouldn't be too hard to restart it without having to do a lot of work. I think the original Federation was subscription based and they had a magazine and there were subs and it was quite a serious organization. So we thought we'd just start it up and see what happens and at least get in touch with all the bookshops and have a communication channel between us and do some things together as well. Mm-hmm. So just try and put on a bit more of a united front.
The Alliance is growing. So last time we spoke it was 20, now it's 30. So do you have any more radical booksellers to recruit?
There are a couple. There's one that I won't name them, but there's one that we keep asking to join and for some reason they won't. They don't actually say no, but somehow we've never managed to get an affirmative yes out of them. But I think in terms of the larger shop-based ones, we probably do.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people that join Radical Books are part of what they do. It's mm-hmm. maybe not everything they do, maybe not even the core, but they do it sufficiently enough and their politics are sufficiently on side that we want them to be a part of the Alliance and they're a useful member. And hopefully we're useful to them likewise. And it's important to be able to look at a map and say, well, if I do want to find a book, where will I find it? Near me. And even if that shop doesn't sell solely political books, it will be worth a visit.
Yeah.
That's partly another reason why we exist, just to have that mental map of just who's out there doing things. And hopefully to encourage new people to join. And I think that has happened a little bit, maybe. There have been some new shops that have joined since we started. I'd like to think that we had some small influence, at least, to make it feel like it's possible.
Do you think that the Alliance helps to lower the risk of starting a new bookshop? Is that something that you aim to do? Because obviously 30 is not a very large number, considering the size of this country and the population here.
No.
So.
And many of those aren't shops either. There'll be concessions or somebody who's doing a regular stall even. Not all of them are physical bricks and mortar bookshops. Definitely there could be more. We'd love there to be more. Do we help lower the risk? I think that's hard to say for certain. We definitely do provide advice when people are starting and even once they're up and running. And there have been people who have approached us who as yet haven't opened a shop, but we've had lengthy conversations about what's required and help people really think through the realities. Hopefully haven't put them off. Hopefully those shops will still come to pass, but it does take a lot of work and there are a lot of risks. Those risks are capitalism. It's rent and it's business rates and all those kind of things that it's expensive to do. The profit margins are low and your overheads are high. So we can't take away those risks, but we can help to point to what you can do to help better make it work. The shops that survive the longest are ones where they don't have as much rent to pay or no rent to pay even in some cases. That makes a huge difference. That's something we can't take away. Yeah. That's a problem we can't solve. But once you are up and running, there are certain things that you can do to cut costs and just make it more efficient for yourself. And hopefully that common knowledge is something we can share.
What kind of other activities do you take as participants in the Alliance?
Some projects have come out of the Alliance. Mm-hmm. The main ones have been the London Radical Book Fair and the two book prizes, which have been the Bread and Roses, which is the adult nonfiction prize, and also the Little Rebels for readers up to about 12 years old. They're the sort of three big set piece things that we've done. And a lot of that has happened not just through the Alliance, through particular shops, but by having activities that we do under one banner. I think that's really important that people, the way they approach these things consciously is that they see that there's a range of shops out there that can come together and do something. Especially the London Radical Book Fair, I think, was an important thing to do because the left's so fragmented, and I think it's very important to do things in common with people that you normally wouldn't necessarily agree with, or maybe not want to be in the room with them in some cases.
You mean like socialists and anarchists and the classic radical left divide?
Yeah, and there's history there, and I'm not trying to brush over any of that. But I do think that it's important to present, well, partly it's about outreach to people who are new to politics and new to these traditions. It can be intimidating, and with the London Radical Book Fair, we really try to, as much as possible, make it welcoming to as broad a range of people as possible and make it something that people can sort of get a sense of the breadth of what's going on out there, and they can make their own considered choices as to what tradition suits them best. But yeah, I think it's important to, the left's not big enough to continuously act in our own little corners. We need to do more together, find those common bridges where we can. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like a soft case of being able to do that. I think it's been successful. We've never really had any problems. There's never really been any infighting and so on. It's always been, I think, a friendly, positive day that people come away from feeling good about. So
there's been a hole left by the lack of a London Anarchist Book Fair as well.
There has. I was going to say, well, restarting this Anarchist Festival, which we saw it as a placeholder, really. It was coming round to the book fair time of the year, and we're thinking, this is terrible that there's not anything going on. Let's just do something. And again, because of the Alliance, we've got connections with other friendly anarchist bookshops and booksellers, and we just encouraged everybody to put something on for that weekend. And now that's coming around again to the second year of that, just in a couple of weeks' time. And it's starting to put some roots down, I think, as a thing to do. Hopefully a book fair will return. And there's enough time in the year to do more than one event. So I'd like to think that the book fair will come back and we'll keep doing the Anarchist Festival as well. Mm-hmm. It's nice because it makes people have to go to the anarchist spaces, seek them out. Maybe they wouldn't have before thought to, and then you're welcomed to go to those places. So hopefully it sort of reinvigorates some of the energy around those spaces. If we do keep doing it, I'd like to see it becoming a bit like the London Radical Book Fair, bringing in new people more. Because I think there is a danger that the same people end up coming to the same events, which has its use, but that's always the challenge for me, is that how do you get new people involved? Is that something to think about? There's no easy answer to that, but that's the next objective, I think.
Is that something that you talk about in the Alliance? If people are coming into a bookshop, they've never been involved in activism or any sort of campaigns, they're looking to find other groups. Is this something that you find happens often in Housemans, and is this something that you talk about in the Alliance?
Definitely talk about it in Housemans. Been talking about it in some of the activities, with the book fair activities, definitely. The same with the Anarchist Festival, we're starting to talk about that. Up until now, we've just been finding the systems to make it work. Mm. I think they're in place. So I think now with the Anarchist Festival, that's something I'm really keen to try and do, is just how do you present this to people that doesn't feel alienating? And there are a variety of barriers that put people off. They all need, all those barriers need addressing. Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest weaknesses with the left, is that it can be off-putting to people. And yeah, if we could overcome that more, how do you know get normal people involved? Because it can become a bit isolated, I think, ghettoised. So that's the biggest hurdle, I think, across the board for activities that we do, that I think anyone in politics does, really. How do you get people involved?
Yeah.
Stay involved.
Yeah, definitely. How have the past couple of years been for the Alliance? Can you talk about any significant events, good or bad?
I think the book trade is doing well in general, and I think the left book trade is doing particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the quality of books being published is really high. Book design is changed a lot since we last spoke 8 years ago. It's really changed a lot for the better. The range of topics covered is vastly improved. I think books were a bit more academic as well. My impression was that the tone of books has become a bit more friendly to readers. All really good developments. And some of the Alliance of Radical Bookseller member bookshops have been doing very well. Just this year, I noticed that this industry book prizes, which, you know, take or leave it, but nonetheless, Newham Bookshop and Five Leaves were both shortlisted for best in their region. Five Leaves actually won their region previous year and became the best independent bookshop in the country. And I think these are things to celebrate, really, because it's not easy to make a shop run financially, keep everyone happy, find, you know, the money to pay everybody. And to do that and do it well, both Five Leaves and Newham have got seasoned booksellers who've been doing it for their whole lives behind them. And that does count for something, I think. There are things that you learn over time. Having that sense of history as well, and just being around and sticking with it, that's a satisfying thing, I think, as well. Having said that, there are shops that have started and with the best intentions, and they're really struggling. And that's not through any fault of their own, you know, that's just because it's really hard, and there's a whole variety of reasons why it doesn't work, and location and all kinds of things can play their role, who the landlord is and so on. So even with the best intention and best work, it doesn't mean that it's going to all fall into place. Other challenges recently have been, there was the attack, let's call it, on bookmarks. I think I lose track of time. Was it last summer now? It was in the last year anyway. Obviously, with the rise of the far right, street on some levels at least, maybe we shouldn't over-exaggerate it, but there is a rise of the right in the UK. And bookshops are public-facing, and they're soft targets.
Mm.
And that's what happened at bookmarks that day. It's a very soft target. It's near to where a demo was happening. And some people had a couple of drinks and decided, wouldn't it be a good idea to go and run around the shop? And it did highlight the need for shops to have security, or plans at least.
Mm.
And it's not as if we have bouncers and security, so we have to think carefully about how to protect
mm-hmm.
our staff, our customers. And the Alliance came in very useful on that level. There are lots of sort of skill sharing, knowledge sharing about how to do that best.
Mm.
So we've encouraged everybody to have a plan in place, just to know what to do, not to be too surprised if it does happen to them.
Maybe also keeping an eye out on things that are happening in the locale to be aware on the day.
Definitely, right? Definitely. In the past here in King's Cross, we used to get a lot of football hooligans coming off the trains and so on. So we still do get lots of sort of shouty people and people objecting to books in the windows and all the rest, but it's never escalated much beyond that for us in recent years, thankfully. So hopefully it will stay that way.
So we're going to take a short break and listen to a track by The Bookshop Band from their album Revolutions, which you can find on Bandcamp. And this song is called The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman.
Hi kids, we hope you'll play along and have fun with this
radio show.
However, please play safely. Before
listening,
ask your parents to help move
the smoldering wreckage
of capitalism
and other objects you might bump into. And please remember, don't run, jump, or dance while playing
Dissident Island
Radio.
Thanks.
Evening all, Andy from the Activist Court Aid Brigade here again. Just a quick reminder, in these difficult times, while the our good colleagues at Green and Black Cross are on pause or restructuring or getting a lot better, as we hope, we will be covering their phone line, so that will still be going. And if you've got any legal requests, please send it in to the ACAB email address, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but having a look on the bus card says courtsupport@protonmail.com. So tonight, having failed to round up any of our many other colleagues who have been out being very brave today at lots of events, I'm sure, I will be talking a little about inchoate offences, about the possibility of using drones to close down Heathrow Airport, and a little roundup of some ongoing cases. But I'm going to start with really good news for our friends, the judges. Now, people might have seen them in courts. They're the ones who sit at the front, usually quite high up, and give you a load of shit. The nation is possessed of 1,850 judges. I managed a Googlepedia today. And the great news for them is that they've got a pay rise. Now, you might be wondering why they've got a pay rise in June, because normally civil servants get their pay rises at the start of the financial year, and indeed judges did get a 2% pay rise in April. But the government has now decided to award them a recruitment and retention allowance, which varies on what sort of judge you are, and there are a big pay scale of judges that you can look up online that goes from 1 to 8, with a couple of extra ones in slotted in. There's a 1.1 and a 5 plus, a 6.1 and a 6.2. So this is mainly affecting the judges higher up, because apparently it's really, really difficult to recruit judges, because and there's a lot of vacancies in the higher courts due to the fact that people don't want to become judges who are earning too much money in private law. So the government has very wisely, in my opinion, decided that Crown Court judges, these are the ones who sit in jury trials, they're getting a 15% pay rise. to the extent that a pay rise of £21,043 a year. So they're now on £161,000. So when you sit there, either in the dock waiting for the judge to send you to jail, just think that they're going to be a little softer on you now, because they're much happier and be able to afford more G&Ts. Oh, actually, they can get free accommodation when they travel around the country, and they get free food at court. So that doesn't particularly affect it. But the significant pay rise, and you might be wondering how the judges have managed to con the government into doing this. There is Crango called the Senior Salaries Review Body that looks at the wages of government employees, and they have recommended a big rise in the pay for judges. And partly this goes back to a change that happened in 2013 to judges' pensions. And judges' pensions got cut in the happy years of austerity. But this was a really foolish thing for the government to do, because the judges are all clever lawyers, and they've taken a legal case against the government that they're winning. Because, one, they're really clever lawyers, and two, the case is being considered by other judges who are all, surprisingly enough, on the side of judges. So the government has been forced to cave in. Therefore, the more senior judges, the ones in the High Court, they've got a 25% pay rise, which is a mere £47,225. There are some other weirdly named judges that hang around for no reason that I've actually ever worked out, like the Master of the Rolls. He's got a £58,000 pay rise. And the top judge, who is the Lord Chief Justice, he's got a £65,000 pay rise and is now on £327,000 a year. So it just shows that however badly off the country may be, however much Brexit may be affecting the economy and whatever, if you are a bunch of influential old white men, it's quite likely that you can pull the strings and get yourself a lot more money. So congratulations, all judges, and commiserations to the ones at the bottom of the table, the little district judges you see in the magistrate court, who are still squandering away on £112,000 a year. Let's hope they get by. The second part, which I'm not asking people to pay a great deal of attention to, but it leads into the next thing, is something called inchoate offences. Now, there's lots of different crimes, which we've gone through on many, many shows, but all of those crimes that you actually commit, like robbing people and beating them up and that sort of stuff, there are additional offences where you're intending to do them, and you can be convicted of an offence even if they haven't happened yet. And so these are what used to be a nice little acronym, CIA, Conspiracy, Incitement and Attempt. But unfortunately, in 2007, the Serious Crime Act got rid of incitement and produced an extremely complicated set of offences called encouraging and assisting. If you like, you can read about them in sections 44 and 46 of the Serious Crime Act, and you can read about conspiracy in section 1 of the Criminal Law Act of 1977 and attempt in the Criminal Attempts Act of 1981. I should say that attempting to commit a crime is a relatively recent innovation in English law and didn't exist before 1784, R versus Schofield. So if you committed the attempt before 1784, you're not guilty of it. So don't worry too much about those. And the other thing to remember with attempt is that you cannot attempt summary-only offences. So those are offences which can only be dealt in the magistrate's court and carry no more than a six-month sentence of imprisonment. So if you're obstructing police officers or obstructing the highway, you can't attempt to do it. However, the new offence of obstructing emergency workers, you can attempt that because it can be heard in the Crown Court and has a maximum of 1 year in jail. There is also the Aiders and Abettors Act of 1861. Which makes it an offence to aid, abet, counsel or procure any offence. Now, why have I bored you with all this? Because if I want to, I'd just say, go and buy yourself a copy of Blackstone's Criminal Practice and read it and save yourself the pain of listening to me on the radio every 2 weeks. But there's been a very, very interesting development that comes to the climate campaign that we have seen blossoming over the country. Is there's been a suggestion from Extinction Rebellion that possibly drones may be flown over Heathrow Airport in order to... you might guess that there are laws against doing that. And you can also guess that Extinction Rebellion, when they put out that this might actually be serious and the maximum sentence is 5 years, got it wrong again, because the sentence is not... It is life imprisonment. And it doesn't particularly matter whether it's under the Aviation Maritime Security Act of 1990 or whether it's a common law offence of public nuisance or, frankly, it's piracy under the 1837 Piracy Act. Whatever law that they can come up with the possible exception of blackmail, of which the maximum sentence is only 14 years, it faces a very, very long time in jail. And if you conspire or encourage or assist an offence, the maximum penalty is the same as doing the offence. So just so anyone is out there thinking, wow, why don't I have a lovely day out flying my drone? They might want to think that they need to do it somewhere that they get put in an inland prison that will not be drowned by the rising tides that will happen by the time their sentence has expired, because it's going to be taken extremely seriously. Our other little development is that the Metropolitan Police have been sending letters to people who are arrested on the Extinction Rebellion, asking them in for voluntary interviews in which you can fez yourself up. Now, I was speaking to one of my esteemed colleagues in ACAB, and they said, I don't know, should we put out a statement telling people not to do that? Or will that just encourage them to do it? So maybe it might be better to give them the wrong advice, and then they might actually do the right thing because they're so obstinate in listening to the good advice that we've been giving them before. But the honest answer is you do not want to go and see the cops unless they've already got you. So the plan is, kids, not going to see the cops if they send a letter saying, come and see us. This will be really, really good for you. And we will conclude this evening's cheerful news is that one of our defendants has had their case dropped, which is Boris Johnson. it's a shame that he wasn't being done for malfeasance in public office, which also carries life imprisonment, which is less than he deserves. But it just once again proves that you cannot use the legal system for real political stuff. You can do it for publicity stunts, but it's cost a huge amount of money and it's always going to be thrown out. So on that happy note, we will be back in a few weeks with more exciting cases and perhaps some more jolly ones.
Great. And now we're going to listen to a track from Big Lad called Donald Tramp in honor of the recent Tramp's visit to our lovely country.
back with our interview with Nick from Houseman's Bookshop, and this time discussing more on the Alliance of Radical Booksellers, hearing about the biggest threats to our local radical bookshops, and how bookshops can be so much more than just a place you buy books. What would you say is the biggest threat right now that the radical bookshops and the Alliance face? Off the top of my head, I would think it would be the big, cheap booksellers like Amazon, to say the A word, but also the adoption of ebooks, maybe people buying less books.
When we last spoke 8 years ago, there was genuine panic, I think, that ebook sales were going up and up and up, magazines were closing. It felt like, what would it take before you reach a certain peak and the distribution model falls apart? And that hasn't happened. Everything's leveled off and ebook sales have flatlined, I think, on the whole. And printed books have gone up in quantity and sales. So that threat seems to be over. Obviously, we'd love to see the back of Amazon and their practices, particularly.
The Alliance specifically behind boycott Amazon.
Most of its members would agree with that. There is also a problem there that publishers, small left publishers, if they want their books to sell, they have to sell on Amazon. I mean, 60, 70% of their sales will come through Amazon. So if you don't offer them your books, you lose a huge readership. It's the dilemma of living in the system we live in. Sometimes you can't just retreat from everything. All you can do, I think, really, above all else, is encourage people to make those decisions for themselves.
Yeah.
I think the biggest threat to independent bookshops is landlords. Wow. And rent. And that's true also for the housing question issue. Mm. Is the biggest issue, I think, at the moment. I think that's where so much money is being sucked out of people's pockets. And it just makes things impossible. The margins on a book are so small comparative to other products that you just can't afford to pay these bills. And we're very lucky here where we are in King's Cross, because the building is owned by a sympathetic organisation, our sister organisation Peace News. And similarly, a lot of the shops that have survived over the years, they've done so because they have an arrangement that means they're not paying full market rent. It's very, very hard to do to make it work on full market rent. Some shops do, and mm-hmm. that's all the more impressive knowing that. That's what's stopping more shops not opening up, is the rent question. And occasionally you can go to the council, you might find a peppercorn rent here or some setup that you can somehow squeeze in with somebody else in another space. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a massive issue for the left in general. I think we don't have a lot of spaces and we have less than we used to. I did actually hear that there's a bit of a revival in the Midlands and north of sort of social clubs are starting to start up again, kind of in the Labour tradition. But that's a positive trend. And if I were to have £1 million falling me from the sky, that's what I would do, is try and buy a building that's just safe now and forevermore. Because once you own it and it's there and it's not going anywhere. Mm. You can do anything you want with it forever. It just makes such a difference. Otherwise, you're always looking over your shoulder, wondering, will the day come that we can't do this anymore?
As has happened to bookshops in London in the past.
Absolutely. I think Centre Prize was another recent black community bookshop in Dalston. And I don't want to say the wrong thing, but my understanding was vaguely that when they were offered the space from a council tenancy, it was on the remit that the work that they were doing was valuable for the community and that the space had to be used for that purpose. But, you know, the councils, I don't want to say it's greedy, because I have some sympathy for the councils. They are being
squeezed.
Beyond squeezed even. I mean, just dried out, and they're desperately trying to come up with where they're going to get their money from, and property is one of the places they're going to do it from. So they are in a bind. I appreciate that, but still, that building was set aside for a particular use, and it's a use that's all too lacking, and Centre Prize shouldn't have shut. It shouldn't have been allowed to shut. It was a council decision. Somebody on the council just didn't care. Yes, there are hard decisions, but maybe I'm biased on that one, but it was sad to see Centre Prize close.
It's been 8 years since we last chatted, and that's been 8 years, 8+ years of austerity. Mm. And these kinds of decisions probably wouldn't be being made if the councils were flush, or at least being able to pay their bills. Biased or not, it's also, I guess, like the age that we live in.
Yes, about internalizing values as well, because other countries, France and Germany in particular, I'm thinking of here, from a state level, they think of bookshops differently and they don't charge the same business rates. They think of them as libraries. Mm-hmm. And I think conceptually they just consider them as, by having these books on the high street in your local area, you're adding to the well-being of the local area. They aren't businesses. They're actually something beyond just something to flog, you know. Mm-hmm. That's correct. I think that's absolutely correct. So both Germany and France have made big steps to try and support their local bookshops in response to seeing them close down, in the same way they closed down here in the UK. So they panicked to a certain extent and thought, we need to do something about this. And that's a cultural and a attitude that sadly is lacking in the UK. There have been some attempts to bring these issues to government, not by the Alliance of Radical Booksellers, but we have been contacted about it, actually. I seem to remember it was, is his name John Bird from The Big Issue? John, that man. He was trying to do something for some reason. I don't know how he got involved, but I think he was going to Westminster and semi-lobbying people there about this, but I don't think it got very far. But yeah, it doesn't have to be this way. It does depend a lot on how people see and understand bookshops in general.
One of the things is, I listened back to our interview from 8 years ago, and by the way, everybody should listen to it because it's fantastic. It was super entertaining. It was really nice to chat about the bookshop and the Alliance and the book award. But one thing that you said was particularly interesting, which is, we shouldn't see our local radical bookshops as businesses. They're really local campaigns. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk a bit about why you think that, and why you think, say, the French and German model of like changing the way that just everything, the tax structure, the way that we allow them to exist, but also from like a personal and a community perspective, why should we see radical bookshops as something beyond just a place that we buy books?
I think going back to what I was saying, that the left in general lacks spaces, that's one way that's really important. It's our physical embodiment in our towns and cities. It's a place that people can physically bump into these ideas. So there is that immediacy of that, which I think is very important. But in terms of community, I mean, with Housemans, having been in this building for 60 years, it's going to be this year. Over the years, so many people have passed through the doors and contacts have been made and campaigns have been rustled up in the basements. And in fact, I mean, the Housemans is part of a larger building here, Peace House, and it all feeds into one another. We recently had a anniversary event for Gay Switchboards, which started in the building. It was their 45th anniversary, I think. And some of the original volunteers were there, and some of the newer people and people who'd used the service.
For people who don't know, what is Gay Switchboards?
Yes, cast your mind back to the 70s. It was a chance for people to get advice on coming out or dealing with their families, or for family members who don't know how to respond to the situation that they find themselves in. It was an advice line, and it was completely innovative at the time. It was the first of its kind, I think. And it was part of a wave of making acceptable homosexuality. And in its current incarnation, it does even wider work around gender and sexuality, but it maintains that support service. But yeah, so that's 45 years of work, and that's ingrained to the shop. Housemans is one of the few places you could buy gay literature, fiction, as well as non-fiction political work. Having people come along and say, I remember 45 years ago when, you know, that office was peeling paint and all the rest of it, all those stories. It's powerful in a more subtle way, because sometimes we feel like we're not getting anywhere. We're losing. It's just more problems. But actually, there are things that are achieved. And if you don't have that sense of permanence, it's hard to see. That's one of the nice things about the building. One of the things that inspires me to work here is a sense that there's a history and it's not finished yet. There's still work to be done, and we're building on past successes, past struggles. And it helps to embody all of that history, I think. And it's a community bookshop as well. I mean, it's a residential area, even though we're in central London here in King's Cross. And there, again, we've got customers who have been coming here for many a year as well, and you do get to know people, and people come and meet in the shop. And obviously we've got a big events program, which is continuously bringing people in as well, new book groups as well. So continuously trying to bring people in to rub shoulders with one another, because much as I'm a fan of the online world, there's something to be said for those physical meetings, and we need the spaces to do them, and bookshops are a very friendly way to do that. So I think it's really has a quite a unique role, way beyond being a shop. It's an excuse almost, isn't it?
We're kind of told that if we're anywhere, we need to have a reason to be there. We need to justify our existence or our presence. But in a bookshop, you can always say you're just looking for a book. You don't have, like, even if you just want to meet other people or pick up flyers for campaigns or go to an event.
Yeah, I think it's a welcoming space, a bookshop. And ideas can be intimidating. History can be intimidating, but seeing them all lined up in the colourful spines on the shelf, that's not intimidating.
The booksellers are all selling literature and provide literature to people on all these issues that we need to learn about. But then those are obviously the resources that you present. Now, do you think about bringing that into the way that you organize and the way that you interact as a radical alliance?
One thing that's been working on hard here at Housemans is trying to improve the, for want of a better word, working conditions in the shop. It's never been a cooperative. It wasn't really hierarchical either. It was a bit of a fudge in terms of the structure, and a lot of stuff was just left to work itself out. So something we've been putting a lot of work in recently is trying to find structure and models that allow the staff to have autonomy and work collectively in consensus, and still fit in with a larger, more complicated hierarchical trustees situation. And these kind of subjects make some people fall asleep, and I can understand why, but in fact it's these sort of nuts and bolts things that make such a difference to people's working lives, specifically when conflict arises. And it's great when everyone's getting on, you can drift through and it'll be fine, but inevitably problems do come up, and there are, and you need good anarchist structures, actually, I think, to deal with those problems. So trying to integrate that into the shop has been the most recent challenge, and I think we've basically got there. We've long had pay parity, and we've long had the same job description, even though we've been doing different things, we effectively have equality there. But as I say, the structure's not been there enough to back it up, and all those meetings and minutes and bits of paper with a structure written down, they're actually really important. I've come to really value that part of organising, I guess, for want of a better word. It's a really good way to avoid conflict, referring to bits of paper.
You like them, Artis? Their music? Of course you do.
Hey, everybody.
Do you make your own music?
Yeah. That's cool.
Is it copyleft?
Creative Commons.
Music.
Or spoken word poetry.
Yeah, really.
Get in touch.
Get in touch.
With
Dissident
Island.
You can do it.
Anytime.
Get in touch.
Get in touch.
Email
us, motherfucker.
At
Dissident
Island.
At
RiseUp.net.
I'm checking my emails. I'm checking my email. Oh, what's this? Oh my goodness. Oh, no, thank you.
Cool. So I have some announcements for you tonight. So definitely check out the Edinburgh Anarchist Book Fair if you can get up there. It's happening on Saturday, June 29th at the City of Edinburgh Methodist Church on Nicholson Square. And there's lots to get involved in on the day. Go to edinburghafb.org for more info. And also, there's the Rent Strike Weekend are coming up, 2 days of housing and direct action workshops in July on the 13th and 14th. So this weekend is for any student activist, housing activist interested in learning about and sharing things around Cut the Rent and anti-gentrification campaigns. People from all over the country will be gathering and will be discussing strategies, sharing tips, experiences, and doing some training workshops. It's a great opportunity to meet people who are fighting the same fight,
and get a morale boost and some pro tips. So you can also hear the lovely chat we had with Rent Strike on episode 234 of Dissident Island, and check out their Facebook for a link to the free sign-up page. And now we'll hear the last part of our interview with Nick, and then a fantastic set by DJ Oleotronics. Now we'll hear the final segment of our interview with Nick from Housemans. With the Bread and Roses Prize for 2019 soon to be announced, we discuss the prize, the shortlist process, as well as some events to keep an eye out in celebration of Housemans' 60th birthday. Now I'd like to talk about the Bread and Roses Prize. Just a couple questions. So back when we talked in 2012, you mentioned that the existence of the prize was to highlight useful political books that serve a function. Do you think that's still the case? Is that the main motivator behind it?
I've got quite a functional view of books, of nonfiction books. Yeah. I think they do have to have a function. Mm-hmm. I think with fiction and poetry, you can be a bit more, you know, languish in the joy of it kind of thing. But with nonfiction, it has to be useful. And who's to say what's useful or not? I think with the Bread and Roses, we try and highlight books that are just particularly of the moment and are particularly well written and accessible and get the message across and mm-hmm. inspire. And definitely year by year, things change in terms of what people are interested in, what's getting published. So when we started, it was not long after the financial crisis, and there were a lot of economics books being published, and everyone was trying to learn, do crash courses in how economics works, quite rightly, and I'm not sure how far we got with that. But yeah, and now I feel like there's definitely a massive boost of publishing around feminism and also around race issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's actually a lot to talk about there. Sometimes you can feel as if just retreading old ground, but actually not only is there a lot of publishing, but there's a lot of innovative thinking going on, or useful thinking, where people are challenging themselves. That's another part, I think. It's got to be something that's challenging preconceptions. So yeah, hopefully the new shortlist has just been announced last week, and hopefully there'll be some books on there that will stimulate people.
How have the books been chosen, and has it changed over the years, the way that you shortlist?
The process has been pretty much the same. Okay. We contact as many publishers as we can and invite them to submit, and that's down to them to submit. We'll chase as much as we can. But what's happened in the past is that one group of people have read to create a shortlist, and the shortlist gets passed over to guest judges. And those guest judges are usually other writers or academics or activists, professionals, as opposed to the more general readership doing the shortlisting. But this year we decided to try something different and have the whole process done within bookshop staff. So bookshop staff are following it through down to choosing the winning books. And I think it is an Alliance of Radical Booksellers Prize. I feel like that feels right somehow. Not only do we fund it, but I feel booksellers should choose, and their opinions should reflect. So that's something we're going to try and do for the next, at least couple of years, I think, is try and focus, make it clearer that it's bookshops who are giving this award. I think there was a sense of book prizes have guest judges, so we should do the same. But maybe that's not necessarily true. I think the idea that it's given by bookshops, I think, has its own unique thing about it. So I'm just trying to embrace that aspect of it. I'd recommend, if anybody's curious, to check out on the websites of Little Rebels Prize and Bread and Roses. Mm-hmm. Have a look at the shortlists on there. And also have a look at the back lists of shortlists. There's loads of good books that, you know, just because they're a year old doesn't mean they're not worth reading. So
definitely,
it's a nice resource, I think, both of those websites of just good books.
Cool. Well, I think that's a wrap. But yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chippy.
Thank you. So this year's 2019 Bread and Roses shortlist includes Natives, Race and Class in the Ruins of Empire by Akala. Can We All Be Feminists? 17 Writers on Intersectionality, Identity, and Finding the Right Way Forward for Feminism, edited by June Eric Udori. Europe's Fault Lines, Racism and the Rise of the Right by Liz Fekete. Revolting Prostitutes, The Fight for Sex Workers' Rights by Juno Mack and Molly Smith. Lights in the Distance, Exile and Refuge at the Borders of Europe by Daniel Trilling. And finally, Alt-Right, From 4chan to the White House by Mike Wendling. And as Nick says, the shortlists from previous years are available on the Bread and Roses website at bread-and-roses.co.uk, and all are still relevant great reads if you're ever looking to pick up a good book. Of course, all the books on this year's shortlist and so many more are available at your local Radical bookshop, so definitely drop by and pick up a copy. This year's prize will be awarded at the Bread and Roses Theatre, which is in King's Cross, London, on Tuesday, the 11th of June, 2019. And many thanks to Nick for all his time and the fantastic work he does in contributing to the Bread and Roses Prize, the Alliance of Radical Booksellers, and Houseman's Bookshop.
These are the angry
voices of Dissident Island
Radio
from London.
Back in the UK!
Listening to the UK segment of Bad News, the UK being the so-called Kingdom of Not-So-United Britain. This is brought to you by Dissident Island Radio, a radical DIY radio collective pumping out twice-monthly shows from London, the capital of capital. Workers organising with the United Voices of the World Union have been busy in London, fighting back against outsourcing and poverty pay, from Chanel to the Hilton Hotel to the Trocadero and University of Greenwich. June started off with cleaners at Chanel winning the London Living Wage, after Carmen, one of the lead organizers for her Latin American colleagues, was suspended by the outsourcing company on preposterous charges in a transparent attempt to shut down the dispute. Chanel offered an initial pay rise of 10% to £9.10 pence an hour, following the continued threat of a strike. Recognizing this was still well below the London Living Wage of £10.55 pence an hour, cleaners continued to fight and moved to ballot for strike action, organizing a mass protest at Chanel's store on New Bond Street. Consequently, Chanel have now confirmed they will pay the full London Living Wage to cleaners across their stores. As the victory at Chanel meant the mass picket was called off, UVW organized further actions against other workplaces in the West End. They marched to the Hilton Doubletree's Hotel at Marble Arch, where a member is owed hundreds of pounds after being paid illegally at well below minimum wage. Members danced in the foyer and demanded to see both the hotel manager and the manager of the contract cleaning firm. Police came and tried to get the union and management to talk. Cleaners who work at the famous entertainment venue Trocadero and the Criterion Building in Piccadilly Circus that overlooks the Trocadero and where annual rent costs £11 million per year have decided enough is enough and are set to down tools and strike until they are paid the London Living Wage. Outsourced to dock cleaning, they are currently paid poverty wages, which at a whopping £2.24 pence an hour under the current London Living Wage. Cleaners are also demanding an occupational sick pay scheme to ensure that they are still paid when they take a sick day. The cleaners have also previously received threats and suffered cuts to their hours in response to having asked for contracts of employment. These buildings are owned by Criterion Capital, that owns and manages a modest 2 billion property portfolio across London and the southeast of England. UVW members working as security guards at St George's University, a medical school in Tooting, South London, and Constituent College of the University of London have voted in an indicative ballot to strike until St George's terminates its contract with contractor Noonan and brings them in-house. UVW will now move to ballot them. Bringing the workers in-house would end the two-tier workforce the security have been subjected to for years, which has seen them severely overworked, disrespected, and under-recognized. In addition, their terms and conditions remain on the pernicious statutory minimums, whilst university staff enjoy generous holiday allowances, pensions, and sick pay schemes. With a £3.1 million increase in St. George's annual income last year, a surplus increase to £3.5 million, any costs involved with in-housing their security guards can easily be absorbed. The two-tier workforces created by outsourcing have been successfully challenged, beginning with UVW's historic victory at the London School of Economics in 2017, which saw the termination of a £5 million a year contract with Nonan, bringing some 250 cleaners in-house after the then-largest cleaner strike in British history. Since then, tertiary educational institutions of SOAS, King's, Birkbeck, and Goldsmiths, with the exception of security, have all followed suit, with Senate House and UCL expected to follow next. Cafe workers at Greenwich University, outsourced Baxter Story, have joined UVW en masse and voted to strike for the London Living Wage to lift them off the poverty pay they currently receive. So check out libcom.org and the United Voices of the World website for more details on strike actions, past, present, and future. And also check out the Dissident Island Radio Show, episode 212, where we chat to the United Voices of the World about organizing with precarious workers. On Thursday, 30th of May, workers at MGT Power Plant in Teesside began a spontaneous protest. The workers had gone on strike at the Tees Renewable Energy Plant, the world's largest biomass power plant being built on Teesside by MGT, over poor safety conditions. The action was sparked by what was described as a boiler incident. The plant's operator has confirmed an incident involving a boiler where a suspended load moved during installation. Nobody was injured in the incident, and soon the area was declared safe by the plant operator. However, workers refused to return to work, with their spokesperson saying that they felt unsafe. The protests caused delays on major motorways and surrounding roads as workers blocked the Tees Dock Road near the plant. The police mounted an operation in response to the protests to clear the road with large numbers of cops and a helicopter present. Check out libcom.org and Freedom News for more details and links. In May, in the lead up to the European Parliament elections, various fascist politicians were milkshaked while campaigning across cities in the UK. Stephen Yaxley Lennon, whose pretend name you might be familiar with is Tommy Robinson, was the first major figure to be milkshaked, having one thrown as a projectile in Bury on the 1st of May and another thrown the following day in Warrington. Carl Benjamin, a UKIP candidate and also an alt-right mouthpiece, had four milkshakes, some horseshit, and a handful of kippers thrown at him while campaigning in Sainsbury's, Truro and Totnes. The kippers, by the way, is a reference to the fact that he is a candidate for the racist UKIP party. Get it? Nudge nudge wink wink. As a bonus, alt-right former poster boy Milo Yiannopoulos was also milkshaked, but this gained very little media attention given his overall irrelevance in today's day. The crowning glory of milkshaking this past month, however, went to Nigel Farage, the renowned fascist politician and former UKIP leader, was hit in the face by a banana and salted caramel milkshake. This happened on the 20th of May while he was campaigning in Newcastle upon Tyne. Paul Crowther was arrested for the action. He was fired from his job at Sky, the television broadcast network, and has been sentenced to 150 hours of unpaid work, £300 in fines, an £85 victim charge, and £85 in court costs. The milkshake actions had a significant effect on the campaign activities, with Nigel Farage being trapped on his campaign bus, not being able to mingle with the crowd for fear of further milkshaking embarrassments, and Carl Benjamin reining in his campaign activities very significantly. There are some great opinion pieces out there, like in organizedmagazine.org.uk, on the politics of milkshaking as an effective form of anti-fascist action. Have a read there for more information and links. And last but not least, June 18th marked the 20-year anniversary of the Carnival Against Capital, which happened 20 years ago on June 18th, 1999. It is considered one of the high points of the anti-slash-alter-globalization movement, along with the WTO protests that happened in Seattle, USA, also in 1999. 20 years on, various radical media outlets have posted links to media and reflections on the protests, which are as relevant today as ever. If you're interested in learning more about this piece of history, check out the article Reflections on June 18, 1999 from libcom.org.